This is WJBC This Week.
We have no intention whatsoever of putting in a flea bag, rent by the hour type hotel.
Anytime you spew an addictive poison in public, it's a health issue.
I'm dumbfounded and flabbergasted at the inability for the judge to see that things are different than they were 4.5 years ago.
He's a, to me, a key example of someone who's learned his lesson.
We know there are going to be some issues that arise, and that's for us to troubleshoot very quickly.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, an author who has covered Donald Trump's business dealings for decades shares his thoughts on the Republicans' presidential campaign. Local officials made a last-ditch attempt to save the Clinton nuclear plant this week. Police issue safety reminders in response to Pokemon Go. An author profiles life in normal in the 1950s through time travel. And an Illinois woman took an unexpected turn into the world of pageantry as a 39-year-old married mother of two. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston has been covering Donald Trump's business dealings for 3 decades. Johnston is the author of The Making of Donald Trump and discussed what he has learned about Trump's real estate empire and financial dealings when he talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
What took you to Atlantic City at that point? What were you reporting on?
Well, I had been an investigative reporter at the LA Times. I was the first person to take on the LAPD's image, and we all know the truth about it today. And it was time for me to go do something else. And I believed we were going to see the spread of casino gambling all across America. So I went to Atlantic City for the Philadelphia Inquirer to see, did the state of New Jersey really clean up the gambling business? And almost immediately, met Trump within just a couple of days of arriving.
Now, was this around the time that he was making a big deal of building or refurbishing the Taj Mahal Casino?
No, this was before that. He had built the Trump Tower in 1987. He had put out his first book, The Art of the Deal, with Tony Schwartz, who did the actual writing. But he was the dominant force in Atlantic City. And what I immediately discovered from when I met him, I thought, this guy is the modern P.T. Barnum, selling us tickets to the Fiji Mermaid and other hoaxes. And as I asked about him around town, from executives of other casinos, from Steve Wynn, who is a very successful, very competent casino operator, and from some of his own guys, I began to learn that Trump didn't know anything about the casino business. He had a license, and he knew how to remove money from the business to send it to him in New York, but he didn't know anything. And it was quite surprising. He didn't understand the rules of the games. He didn't understand managing customers, and it's why his casinos were not top performers.
Yet, I think that if you would have asked anybody at the time who one of the major casino operators was in New Jersey, in Atlantic City, just like if you asked people in New York who one of the major developers was, they would say Donald Trump, because the one thing that he seems to be extremely good at is building his brand and getting his name out there.
Yeah, Donald is the most successful manipulator of journalists I have ever met. Donald understands the conventions of journalism. He understands that most journalists accurately quote what other people tell them, but they don't know anything more than that. They don't have a deep structural knowledge of how things work. And so he is able, particularly with the tabloids in New York and with television, to create these two false images of himself. One is as the modern Midas, where everything he touches turns to gold. A lot of it turns to dross. And the other is that he is the great Don Juan. And there are a handful of reporters, Wayne Barrett, myself, a couple of others, who saw right through this stuff because we understand on a very deep level how things work.
Well, would he try to work you back then when you were reporting on the casino industry? Would he try to turn you around and see how he could get you to write the things he wanted you to?
Well, with somebody like me, Donald's approach, once he knows who you are, is essentially romance. Oh, you know, I like this really thing you did here or there. And then menace, you know, we're going to sue you. I'm going to talk to your boss, whatever. You know, I've had foreign governments follow me. I've been spied on by the LAPD and had my cars burglarized. You know, he's not in the league of serious people on stuff like this. But with most journalists who are looking for a good story and don't have a deep knowledge of things, Donald really is able to run.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what he is good at and how he has maybe taken some of those skills that you talk about, especially with the media, in achieving what he has as far as politics goes. How much of Trump's success is that he is really just a cult of personality? You know, he presents himself as either the very best, as you say, and in his campaigning now, he is almost blatantly saying, well, I'm the only person that can run America. I am the best. He has said, and right. It's almost a quote here if it's not an exact quote.
Oh, no, Donald has said, I alone can solve your problems. Well, first of all, nobody can do that. Donald is a world-class narcissist, and Donald believes that he is superior to everyone else. And either you recognize this, in which case you worship and adore Donald, or he has a word for you. Loser. The reality is, and my book, The Making of Donald Trump, documents this from his own writings, his own speeches, his own testimony in cases, that he doesn't know anything. I teach part-time in the law and graduate business school at Syracuse University. There are questions my students can answer at the snap of a finger that have been asked of Donald under oath, and the answers he gives, and I quote one of them in the book. It's fairly long and complicated, but I show what it is. And his answers are gibberish. He doesn't know anything. Remember, he didn't even know what the nuclear triad is. Now, maybe some of the people listening don't know. That is, as Marco Rubio schooled Donald, the capacity of the United States military to deliver a nuclear weapon from a submarine missile, a land-based missile, or from a bomber. Donald, on national TV during one of the debates, didn't know what it was. 4 months earlier, the same person, the right-wing talk show host Hugh Hewitt, had asked the exact same question, and his answer was gibberish. And in the 4 months in between, Donald didn't try to learn. Donald doesn't know anything. He doesn't even understand the Constitution. He thinks the President of the United States is a dictator. No president can act without legislation. No legislation moves without the approval of the Speaker of the House. And yet until Donald suddenly endorsed Paul Ryan, he was picking a fight with him. That makes no sense whatsoever to anyone who understands how our system of government works.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with David K. Johnston. He is an investigative reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner, and has written a book about Donald Trump called The Making of Donald Trump. He has been covering Donald Trump off and on since the 1980s. So, David, one thing that Donald Trump does seem to know is how to make money. Maybe not to the extent that he claims, but even considering the fact that he got a nice-sized loan from his father to start his first business, he has amassed wealth.
Oh, Donald has. Donald is a wealthy man. I don't think there's any evidence that he's worth the kinds of money he wants you to think. And in fact, under oath, when he was asked, well, how do you determine your net worth? Most of us determine our net worth by adding up what we own and subtracting what we owe to others, right? Donald said that his net worth depends on his emotional state. And by the way, when Donald was a baby, when he was in diapers, his trust fund was collecting four times the average income of American families. Donald started out on third base and hasn't done especially well considering where he started out from. What Donald's masterful at in business is seeing an opportunity to extract money, not to build a business, to create wealth, but to extract money. And I've taken apart many of his deals. I've spent countless hours going through legal documents and whatnot. And there's a consistent pattern. Donald has a deal that allows him to extract money. And many, many, many of these deals were done with con artists, swindlers, drug traffickers, mob associates and mobsters, which shouldn't be surprising if you know that his father's business partner was a guy named Willie Tomasello, who was an associate of the Gambino and Genovese crime families.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. You point to a number of connections with Trump's building projects that are involved with construction companies that are known to have ties to organized crime, and you write about that in the book. Has there been a dearth of reporting on this issue?
Well, yes, there has. And some people are going to say, well, everybody has to deal with the mob in New York. That's actually not true. But Donald has numerous deals that have nothing to do with construction, where he chose to go do business with other people. There were construction families in New York, notably the Lefrak family and the Resnicks, who went to the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the late 70s and said, will you please free us of these mobsters? While they were doing that, Donald was embracing these mobsters. And when there was a cement strike, a concrete strike in the summer of 1982 when Trump Tower was being built, every construction project in New York didn't have concrete except one, Donald Trump's company.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, I think if you presented Donald Trump with this idea, he might candidly say, well, see, that's a good example of what a strong leader I am and how I am a strong negotiator and I was able to get done what nobody else can get done. Negotiation is very key to what he says is his strong suit when it comes to solving the problems of the United States, especially when it comes to trade deals. He says he will renegotiate and get better deals. Can you give any examples from your reporting and from the book of good or bad negotiations Donald Trump has been involved in?
Donald has a long history of actually paying high prices when he could have paid lower prices. He has a long history of having other people go negotiate the deals that turned out to be good deals. And I cite them in the making, some of these in the making of Donald Trump. In the case of trade deals, you know, we basically don't have any trade barriers anymore. They're of no consequence. Tariffs are insignificant. The issues about trade in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the proposed Atlantic Partnership, both of which I've written about a great deal, have in many ways to do with protecting monopoly rights of American companies and granting benefits to foreign companies that would interfere with American sovereignty. So I've been very critical of those deals, but Donald thinks that they're about something totally different than they are because, again, Donald doesn't know anything. It's all a con. And if you listen to him carefully, you'll notice he always talks in vague circumstances. He if you ask him, you know, well, what women you want to have in the in your cabinet? He goes, well, there are just so many. There's so many. Ivanka, for sure, his daughter. If you ask him, because he says no one reads the Bible more than Donald, well, what's your favorite Bible passage? You know, what do you think about in the Bible? And Donald goes, oh, there's so many. There's so many. I mean, I can't pick one because he doesn't know anything.
That was author David K. Johnston with Steve Fast. Exelon officials have made clear they fully intend to close the nuclear plants in Clinton and the Quad Cities. In fact, they've already started to get the regulatory ball rolling on taking the sites offline. Some local officials seem to suggest the company could be bluffing. They're still trying to get the laws changed in Illinois that they say would cause Exelon to change its mind. Clinton City Administrator Tim Folliwell is one of those administrators who signed a letter delivered to state lawmakers this week. And Folliwell talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Where else is that letter going?
It's being sent basically, well, one, it's being sent to the media right now to get the blast out there that New York has actually made a movement to accept nuclear into the clean energy package that they have in New York. And that's been part of the goal here all along under the Green Energy Plan, is to get the state of Illinois to recognize nuclear energy as a green energy provider, as they do wind and solar. And that was to get them in the same corridor as the incentives that's offered to wind and solar, which helps them stay viable in the reducing price market of electricity. And that's the thing that's building, let's say, more debt for Exelon of why they're not making money here in Clinton, because the price of electricity is actually too low, which is great for the consumer, but it's not good for the producer. The bigger issue we're trying to make certain to get the message out is New York did all their homework. They did the hard work. They went through the analysis. They got it pushed forward. It should make an easier path if our legislators choose to head that way to make a similar deal, a similar option. The biggest thing we're concerned with in Illinois, and I just got done telling one of the TV stations this, yes, devastating to DeWitt County, Clinton, school districts, everything else. If you lose 54% of your EAV on taxes, you're going to be devastated. Same way in the Quad Cities, and I don't think it's quite to 54%, but it's in the same neck of the woods. You can never, ever replace the EAV. You can definitely never replace the jobs in a manufacturing world at that pay level because of that highly skilled expertise work that they do. You're between $70,000 to $90,000 medium income per employee at those power stations that you never can duplicate again. But if you take nuclear off the grid, they no longer produce power. Supply and demand equation just changed, and we will artificially, by doing that, shove the price of electricity up across the state of Illinois, which will impact almost every homeowner, but more so every business that may be struggling to stay in business with the way the economy is today, and we're going to take their power and spike it and hope that doesn't have another ill effect. We're more concerned about the future job losses if we don't do something.
I was talking with State Senator Chapin Rose a while back about the power grid and how the closure of the nuclear power plants would have an effect on that and may force the power plants to stay open. Do you know what the status of that study is currently?
As far as we know, the survey or the analytic study has not been completed yet, and we're in the MISO grid system down here because the other one's PGM up north that the Quad is in. So we're waiting on whatever the finding from MISO comes, and unless Senator Rose knows better, which he always knows better than I do, but I don't know that Quad is actually happening yet, because the way I understand it, the grid analysis doesn't start coming until the closer date of closure of the power station. And since we're tentatively June of 2017, for them to get everyone's blessing, they had to start the grid analysis as we speak. So we know that one's being done, and I would assume the findings from it should be coming forth here within the next 30 to 45 days.
But I take it you don't want it to come down to that, and you'd rather see legislation come out of Springfield to keep the plant open.
Absolutely. I mean, because I'm not concerned one way or the other whether the grid can have enough power or not. If it doesn't, it just goes to scenario what I just said, which is the same thing Senator Rose says. Price of power is going to go up extensively because, one, for them to meet that supply-demand, they now got to go purchase power from some other provider, which means you don't get that at a cheap rate because you're buying at a high commodity time, so you're going to buy at a high rate, which means eventually it's going to get passed on to all the consumers. We're more concerned there job-related-wise than we are anything else, and that's the reason the legislators have to do something. Otherwise, we're going to see a potential ripple effect.
As you know, Bloomington Normal, we have lost our Mitsubishi plant. Lots of folks losing their job there. How would you compare the closing of the power plant to the closing of Mitsubishi, and what would be next for the village of Clinton if the nuclear power plant does shut down?
Well, here's the difference between Mitsubishi and the nuclear power plant. Similar in the aspect that they are both very, very good paying jobs. Mitsubishi was kind of second to none, maybe right behind State Farm in a roundabout way. But when Mitsubishi left, you're still left with a footprint that you might be able to get someone to take. Someone to come in and do some other production, some other use, some other benefit out of it. Nuclear power plant is not replaceable by anybody. When you lose it, it's gone. You can't go to the next people and say, here, take that over. It doesn't work that way. So that is the biggest difference in those two scenarios. Bad enough to lose Mitsubishi because DeWitt County had an effect because we had a good number of employees that worked that way. Also, just like the power plant, I believe there's 130, if I remember right, rough number of people that live in McLean County that work at the power station. So similar effect, but at least Bloomington Normal can work with a future developer on the Mitsubishi property and hopefully get something back.
That was Clinton City Administrator Tim Folliwell with Terry James. Pokemon Go has been all the rage this summer, but the smartphone game has been a bane for Bloomington police, who report several incidents tied to the game. Police Chief Brendan Heffner and spokeswoman Sarah Mayer talked about it with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
Have there been actually any Pokemon problems in the city of Bloomington?
We had in July at Miller Park, we had an individual 19-year-old playing Pokemon Go when they were attacked by 6 to 7 males and physically battered and injured. Non-life-threatening, but serious enough, it required a hospital visit. We have made one arrest in that case, and it's still under investigation, but the arrest was for aggravated battery and mob action.
Was the motivation to steal the phone or just random act of violence?
I don't know what the motivation was. Certainly the individual had a phone. They were playing Pokemon Go.
Right.
But certainly concerning that, you know, someone in a park would be attacked.
That's obviously the worst of the worst scenarios. So is the advice in this case not to be out that late by yourself? Are we that concerned of security at Miller Park?
Well, this was at 5:30 p.m., so yeah. It wasn't out late. But it is a lesson to always be aware of your surroundings. And if something makes you know feel uncomfortable or you kind of get a gut feeling that, hey, maybe this is an unsafe situation, try to be aware of your surroundings and get yourself to an area of safety.
Has it caused an influx of phone calls to 911 of people thinking something else is going on when actually people have just been playing Pokemon?
Not a huge influx. We had, as you mentioned, an individual was walking their dog, and this was late at night, and they thought a car was following them. We made a stop on the car, and it turns out, you know, there were some people in the car playing Pokemon Go, so they were driving slow to, you know, capture the Pokemon. And then we did also have another car on Center Street, which was driving incredibly slow, caught the eye of an officer, a traffic stop. They got probable cause for a traffic stop, and the driver was actually suspended. The passenger was playing Pokemon Go, not the driver.
So that's definitely a distracted driver ticket, but is it also a ticket for proceeding too slow?
No, this was just, they arrested the driver for suspended. So
okay.
He didn't have the phone or anything in his hand.
Distracted driving is obviously a problem for a lot of people. And I will ask this of you, Chief Heffner. The state of New Jersey is talking about putting in a new law that would make you a distracted driver and have the ability to be pulled over for a $300 fine if you are eating or drinking in your car. Beyond cell phone distractions, now your cup of coffee on the way to work, or if you go through a drive-thru and grab something, if you were eating that while driving would be a ticket. Would you like to see that here?
I don't know. I mean, there are people who can't do anything or shouldn't do anything but drive. There are other people who can multitask and do a lot of things, but I think that would be extreme for our area.
Caffeine addicts, we appreciate that.
Caffeine addicts, people putting makeup on. I just think that would be very extreme, but, you know, when the lawmakers come up with things, we have to enforce it. But I think that would be pretty tough to get passed in Illinois.
The Bloomington Police Force does have the ability to pull people over, though, for being a distracted driver, obviously talking on their cell phone or doing anything like mascara at 50 miles an hour, correct?
Yes, and if I could, I can emphasize hands-free. I see a number of people, and you see it mostly when I'm driving my personal vehicle, and they're driving, and it's obvious they have the speaker phone on their phone, and they're driving, and the phone is like 8 inches from their face, and I believe they think that is hands-free or not distract. It is still illegal. It's supposed to be hands-free. That means the phone should not be in your hand.
And you're also, though, illegal if you're talking even hands-free through a school zone. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Yes. So construction zone, school zones, you're actually supposed to disconnect the phone call.
That was Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Heffner and spokeswoman Sarah Mayer with Susan Saunders. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The town of Normal is featured in a book series that takes us back in time to the 1950s. author Randy McWilson is author of the Back to Normal series. He talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
Have you been to normal before?
Absolutely. You know, when I was working on this series, I actually spent time in the wonderful communities of both Bloomington and Normal, interviewed people. The book series is set in the mid-1950s, and the majority of the book series, and actually spent time with people who grew up there in the 50s, interviewed them. I read yearbooks that were signed in the 50s. I watched films of Bloomington Normal from the 50s to see how people dressed, how they interacted with each other, and went to the library, went to the archive center, and took hundreds of photos from all over town because I wanted this series to be as realistic and as rooted in reality as possible, so the reader was never pulled out of the mystery and intrigue of time travel by some slip or faux pas in the actual narrative. And so absolutely love the area.
Good for you for doing research like that, because a lot of people would have just looked on the map and said, oh, Normal, I can, that's a cool name for a town. I'll just go ahead and start using it without having ever come here. But tell us how the series begins, because there are a lot of references to the town of Normal and things like that. Obviously, it's a centerpiece of the books, but tell us how this all began, because if you are a sci-fi person and you live in Bloomington Normal, you have to do these books, folks. I'm telling you. Randy, how's the story begin?
Well, would it be too cliche to say let's travel back in time?
You know, I could have gotten some back in time music. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's right. We needed maybe some Rod Serling, you know.
Yeah.
But if we go back to January of 2011, I was doing some video production. I'm a media producer, and I do television and filmmaking, and I teach media. And I was heading to a shoot, and I'd hired a guy to help me with lighting. And as we were driving, I was telling him about some movie scripts that I've been working on. And he said, you know, I had a dream the other day that I think would make a good seed, kind of a seed bed, or at least a bit of an inspiration for a movie. And I said, well, we've got a few hours on the road. Let me hear it. And he said, well, I dreamed about a guy from our time who fell asleep on the couch, and he woke up in a motel, and it was the early 1950s, and he had no idea how he got there, and the first person that he met was a cop. And he goes, and then I woke up. And so I said, well, really what you've given me is a basic time period, the 50s, the early Cold War. And I said, you've given me the idea of time travel and that there's a policeman. But, you know, that's just a little bit of a seed of an idea. So I said, let's develop that. And so in the next, we had 3 hours down, 3 hours back driving. We developed this entire concept, and I let him kind of in on my creative process of how I think about stories and develop stories. And before the day was out, had really a basic framework for the whole concept that what if there was a group of people living from different decades, so the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, 90s up until our time, were all living in the town of Normal, Illinois, not 100% sure how they got there, and they're trying to get back to when they came from. Notice I didn't say where they came
from. Yeah,
yeah. To when they came from, and what if some influential members of the community, such as the police chief, was also a time traveler. And so in the midst of all this, you have the CIA has become aware that somewhere in America, there is a group of people, a pocket of people that are from the future that are trying to stay under the radar for some reason. And then the KGB becomes aware that the CIA becomes aware of this group of people. And so it's this international geopolitical race to see who can capture this group of people from the future before they can get away because of what that would be worth to the intelligence community. It's a thriller. It's an intellectual thriller. It's a historical thriller. And it's an emotional thriller because my goal in the series was to make the reader wonder, what would it be like if 1 second I'm playing catch with my son in the front yard, there's a flash of lightning, and the next moment I'm in a field in the Midwest and I have no idea how I got there, and then I discover I'm 60 years in the past. What would that be like emotionally? And then what steps would a person go through? Denial. And, you know, and so through the main character, Denver Wayne Collins, he experiences all the steps that we would all go through to try to believe that this is not real. And then he discovers these other people. And then it is just a roller coaster of geopolitical intrigue until they can try to find out, is it possible to get back to when they came from.
It's an incredible concept that you developed very well, and you've gotten four books out of it already. Will people from Bloomington Normal recognize any of the places or the scenery that you have developed in these books?
It is so gratifying when I check Amazon and I see reviews from readers and that are giving their ratings and reviews. How many times you read someone say, I grew up in Bloomington Normal. I went to school in Normal. And this book took me right back to my childhood. This book series was, the Normal Theater, as you guys know, Steak and Shake was born in Normal, and the Steak and Shake gets some prominent mention actually all through the series, and different street names and the university and different locations are all completely accurate in Bloomington Normal. And people have applauded me for putting that much detail into it, because like you said, you could have just picked an interesting sounding city and then made the rest of it up. But I wanted as much of it to be absolutely rooted in history so that if someone really was from that area, the believability factor, nothing would ever pull them out of the story as an obvious or glaring error. And, the feedback that I'm getting from people, as a matter of fact, just today I got an email from a librarian in Normal that said she is hooked on the story and that she found out about it through some readers who came in the library and asked her about it and said their whole family was hooked on the series and that it should be in their library. And so people from that area are really, really connecting with this story in exactly the way that I wanted them to.
That was Back to Normal author Randy McWilson with Dan Sweeney. This year's Mrs. Illinois is an unlikely winner, a 39-year-old married mother of two, and she'll soon be competing for the national Mrs. America pageant in Las Vegas. Crystal Cavey of Plano has a personal platform to be your personal best. She talked about her unexpected entrance into the pageant world when she joined WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
Help us understand, what is the difference? Is it just the fact that you're married? Is the difference between Miss America Illinois and Mrs. America?
Well, Mrs. America, it has three levels of competition. Mm-hmm. So 50% of your score is based on interview. So it's really your ability to draw an audience, speak. If someone handed you the microphone, to be able to talk to people for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and be comfortable in your own skin enough to tell your story. That's the true defining category, is the interview. Then there is 25%, which is gown, and 25%, which is swimwear. Mm-hmm. And I always say the big difference is there's no talent.
Okay.
So, and then you have
there is talent.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
The you're balancing comes, you're balancing the life of a married woman and being a parent with the life of a pageanteer.
That's right. I mean, the most important thing is that, yes, my job is to show married women everywhere, moms everywhere, women everywhere, that regardless of your age, where you come from, where you're going, you can be anything you work hard for.
I like any opportunity to get into formal wear. There seem to be limited opportunities in our adult life to wear the formal wear. And anytime you can feel beautiful and really have that special night. But when you're in the pageant world, you get to wear the best of the formal wear.
It really is. That is really, that's the fun part. And that comes after the interview that you spend a lot of time preparing for and really getting to know yourself. It's the mental, emotional, and spiritual preparation that comes with it, and then you get to go on stage and be in the formal wear, which is fun.
Well, let's break this down a little bit. Do you have a platform? When I watch the Miss America, mm-hmm. Miss USA pageants, each contestant usually has a very special substance to their delivery. They want to talk about a specific topic. What is yours?
My platform is a self-created platform called Be Your Personal Best, and it really is twofold. It's about volunteerism awareness and realizing that giving back to your community is not someone else's job. It's your job to demonstrate to the youth of America and the youth nation worldwide that they can do more. And it's about women's empowerment. And I created an online organization called Ladies of Leadership, where we're empowering 10,000 women across the globe to communicate their stories and their overcoming of obstacles with each other to grow each other.
This is Crystal Cavey. She's from Plano, Illinois. In May, she was crowned Mrs. Illinois America, and in 2 weeks, she will be competing for the national Mrs. America title. Now, you have a husband named Billy.
I do.
And you also have two children, Tori and Raymond. Tori's in studio with us this morning. Hi, Tori.
Hi.
How old are you, sweetheart?
I'm 14.
14. See, I can't tell at all. You could have told me 26, and I would have believed it, except for mom was 39, so that wouldn't have really worked out there with the math. What is it like to have a pageant mom?
Well, I think it's pretty awesome, to be honest. I mean, we do them together, and we get to make so many memories together. And just seeing my mom do what she loves is just so amazing for me, too, because I get to know what that's like to do something that you love, too. And just seeing all the opportunities that we both have gotten from pageantry. And, yeah, I just think it's awesome.
What pageants have you been competing in?
Well, right now I have a national title of American Royal Beauty's National Junior Teen. I've also competed in Miss Royalty International. I was their preteen title holder in 2014.
My goodness.
And I've been competing for about 3 years, so I've done a few pageants.
All right. Crystal, who went into pageants first, you or Tori?
Tori was first. The only reason I ever stepped on the stage in the first place was because I wanted to coach her in interview, but I needed to know what it felt like to be on the other side of the table. So I had competed.
Was it your first pageant in May?
My first pageant was when I was 37.
And then you came back and said, okay, I kind of like this. I want to try it again. Is the Mrs. Illinois and America pageants the only opportunity for girls and women who are married to compete, or are there other, what I should, I don't want to say adult pageants, but mm-hmm. are there other pageants that accept married women?
There are plenty of pageant systems that accept married women, and each pageant system across the country will score things differently. They look for different areas of competition. Mrs. America, I love the scoring system. I love the fact that it is 50% based on what you have to say and your drive and your motivation, and that's what drove me to go to Mrs. America. That's the first thing. The second thing is actually when I interviewed for my very first pageant and I went to compete, when I was all done, and I actually won that pageant out of Wisconsin, the lady behind the judges' table came to the side and said, you really should consider being on the Mrs. America stage. You've got a lot to say, and I really think you would do well. And it took me a couple of years to muster up the guts to go do it, but I went out in May, on May 20th, and did it, and came home with the title of Mrs. Illinois.
That was Mrs. Illinois, Crystal Cavey, with Susan Saunders. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. A federal judge upheld former Governor Rod Blagojevich's 14-year prison sentence on corruption charges. Blagojevich appeared via video link from his Colorado prison for the resentencing hearing in Chicago. Blagojevich's brother Robert says the former governor has learned his lesson.
He's, to me, a key example of someone who's learned his lesson, and now he wants to regain his freedom so he can better serve his community again and as a repaired, better citizen.
Blagojevich had asked the judge to be sentenced to just 5 years, which would have made him a free man within months. Judge James Zagel said, quote, these are serious crimes that had an impact on the people of Illinois. An attorney for Brian Peterson issued a not guilty plea in court this week on charges the Bloomington man stabbed his parents to death. Peterson said nothing during the brief hearing on Friday. He was to undergo a psychiatric evaluation to determine if he is fit to stand trial. The prosecution was granted Peterson's medical records. He is accused of killing his parents, Bruce and Nancy Peterson, at their home in rural Bloomington last month. Developer Jeff Gabelhausen addressed the Bloomington City Council this week, trying to clear up any misperceptions about his latest idea for a downtown hotel.
We have no intention whatsoever of putting in a Fleabag, rent-by-the-hour type hotel. Okay? I've seen it printed enough times. We have zero interest in that. Personally have zero interest in that. You obviously have no interest in that. Let's just be clear. Let's stop talking about that.
Gabelhausen says the hotel would still be located at the front and center building, but would be smaller than the $52 million deal for the hotel and conference center that the council recently shelved. Gabelhausen adds they do not plan on asking the city for any funding. No more vaping at city-owned buildings in Bloomington. That decision handed down this week, Mayor Terry Renner.
This is a health issue. Anytime you spew an addictive poison in public, it's a health issue. But this is comparatively minor if you compare it to, for example, to cigarettes and cigarette smoking of the past. But there is definitely evidence to suggest that it is harmful.
The ordinance was passed unanimously. While the use of e-cigarettes will no longer be permitted at city-owned buildings, vaping will remain legal at private-owned property. A fine of $100 will be levied to first-time offenders, a $250 fine handed down for each subsequent violation. Unit 5 is having to work around many construction projects in the Twin Cities as it figures out its bus routes for the coming school year. WJBC's Adam Stasinski has more.
Superintendent Mark Daniel says something the district will probably have to deal with for a while is the construction on Rab Road near Normal Community High School. He says the town of Normal will be placing officers in the area to control traffic.
And that will be happening at both Rab and Airport, so we want to facilitate the flow of that traffic. And right now it's very, very important for those buses, once they start rolling, that they're allowed to roll as quickly as possible.
District reconfigured its school start times this year in order to better facilitate its transportation. Daniel says they won't know for sure if the strategy worked until school is underway. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
And a group of juveniles has been charged in connection with the vandalism at St. Mary's Catholic School in Bloomington last month. Three boys ages 9, 10, and 11 and a 14-year-old girl were all charged in McLean County Court with burglary to a school, criminal defacement of a school property, and criminal damage to school property. Two of the juveniles have also been charged with theft from the school. They are due in court in early September. Meanwhile, school officials working feverishly to prepare the building say they should be ready for classes this week. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, WJBC helps kick off the fall sports season at Illinois State with its annual fall preview at Hancock Stadium. WJBC's Dick Lucky, Ted Schmitz, Craig Burchie, and Nick McClintock will be broadcasting live from 3 to 7. Also Monday, Connect Transit will launch a new fixed-route bus network in the Twin Cities. Bloomington City Council members will get a final report on a proposed downtown hotel that city officials have panned. On Tuesday, the McLean County Board expected to fill its latest vacancy, with Josh Barnett taking over for Benjamin Owens, who he defeated in the March primary. On Thursday, the local nonprofit Books to Benefit will present a donation to an adult literacy program. And on Friday, United Way of McLean County will hold its annual campaign kickoff breakfast and day of action at the Park Regency Hotel and Conference Center in Bloomington. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Starr.